Hi, and welcome to episode number 181 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. I am Mark, and I'm here with my colleague Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Yeah, you Mark Mandel or Mark Merchandani?
Merchandani. That's a good way to stumble through the fact. Don't know how to pronounce it. You know, I feel like I've done a lot of last name jokes here, though, but I'm not going to hold it against you.
Yeah, you should. You should give me grief for that for a long time.
it's a long last name. So, Mark Mandel, right?
Sure.
With the Y's in it and everything?
Yeah, that's fine. That sounds good. Excellent. Who do we have joining us this week?
So this week,
the topic.
So this week, and I hope I pronounce her name correctly, but it should be Angela Yu.
I believe so.
Chatted with about the Google Maps platform.
Yes.
Which I think a lot of people are familiar with maps in general.
Yep.
But in this case, we're talking a little bit more about like some of the recent updates that have been done there.
Yep.
And how you can actually build some really, really cool ideas with maps, right? Like it's more than just an API.
Yeah.
It's actually a new way to approach thinking about building your app or your website or whatever it is.
Yeah, being able to use that local data and the information that they have in Google Maps within your own application is pretty awesome.
But before we get to that, we've also got to talk about our question of the week, which in this time will be a little bit about Kubernetes and what is Helm, the package manager for Kubernetes.
So, I think Mark, you were just like, I don't know what this is, Mark, can you tell me? So I was like, okay, cool.
I feel, I've talked about it before and I've like understood it at a high level, but then it kind of came up and we'll talk a little bit more about this later. But it's like, what is Helm and why Helm?
Why is it a thing? Cool. But yes, before we get into all of that, we do have our cool things of the week. Looks like I'm going first this week. Haha, excellent. So this week we have several cool things. I'm particularly excited by this. We have announced that Google has entered into a definitive agreement to acquire Looker. It's a unified platform for business intelligence, data applications, and embedded analytics. Basically, they make really pretty graphs that are really easy to understand. It's really nice.
Which a lot of people highly desire because I forget who was saying it earlier, but they were basically saying, there's a lot of solutions out there for doing the actual analytics, the calculations, and that's all fine and dandy. But at the end of the day, someone's got to look at this and make decisions based off of it.
Yeah.
And you can't do that without basically being able to visualize it or summarize it in a meaningful way.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about this upcoming acquisition. So keep you updated on how it all goes. But yeah, it's gonna be neat.
I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of kind of new tools that people can get their hands on here at Google, we've just kind of launched out, I saw a blog post earlier, about the version 3 of the translation API.
Ooh.
That a lot of people are familiar with, right? You send it some text, you kind of send it some information, and it translates it. Well, now with the new version, it's actually super cool because you can kind of create your own glossaries. So that's really helpful for business-specific logic and any terms that are like tied into what you're trying to do. And you can actually specify which model you want to use. So whether it's Google's built-in models or if you want to provide custom ones, they're making it easier and easier to train your own models like AutoML, those kind of things. It's super awesome to kind of bring more customization. I think a lot of people have always wanted translation, and it's always been a little tricky because you have like deep technical talks and everyone's kind of mentioned all these products and translations. Like, I don't know what those are. Well, now you can kind of specify those and really get some really cool results.
That would be cool. I can see a lot of use cases for that. Games.
Not that we make up a lot of words when you have to go, fight the space alien. I want to throw in brand names here because I know them, but I don't want to get in trouble for it.
Yes, but there's anywhere that you have a custom vocabulary, I think is always useful. Well, in last week's episode, we talked about a Google Cloud Networking in Depth article. This week, there's a whole new one. It's Google Cloud Networking in Depth Cloud CDN.
Ooh.
So if you wanted to see basically how Google Cloud uses its points of presence and its edge locations to be able to cache and load balance your information at the edge so that people can get faster access to it, and also how you can use the Cloud CDN product and what features it has so that you can take advantage of that as well explicitly within your applications, this is actually a really good little article. So it gives you some background and also tells you a little bit about how you can use the thing using Google Cloud's HTTPS load balancer and how to configure it and sort of patterns that you can use as well for that.
I mean, it's just like a great place, especially to start understanding, like if you're going to throw up something as simple as a website.
Yep.
Or if you want to do something much more advanced, like huge asset repos.
Yep.
Like understanding a little bit more of those CDNs is great. And I think there'll be more articles in that same vein about like deep dives for networking.
Well, at least if we've said so on the podcast, they have to do it.
I mean, now they're obligated.
Now they're
Once
obligated.
This goes live.
That's it.
We might get in trouble for that. Speaking of last week, actually, we were also talking about ways to save money on Google Cloud. And one that just kind of came up again is very similar to the talk we had last week. So if you haven't seen that, go back and check it out. It's really cool YouTube talk about how to save money. In this case, there's a really, really quick write-up on how to turn on and off compute instances with functions.
Oh, nice.
So maybe if Kubernetes is too complicated for you, like it is for me, then it might make a lot of sense to do something a lot simpler, depending on your workload, where you can basically just say Cloud Scheduler, which is basically manage cron, and you just say, okay, well, at 9 o'clock, turn my machine on, and at 5 o'clock, turn it off.
Oh, nice.
Super simple.
Yep.
Maybe 4 lines of code. I mean, it just basically has Cloud Scheduler calling cloud functions, and that's about it. Super great to have, and the blog post kind of checks out the details there. So definitely a cool, cool, simple way.
Yeah, especially if there's just something you want to run once a day, for example.
Yeah, definitely extensible too, right? Because the business logic might say, start it up early, whatever it is.
All sorts of neat stuff. Finally, I just wanted to make mention, unfortunately, last Sunday, we had an outage. There is an article that we have posted up on the Google Cloud blog talking about the outage and the incident that occurred, including an apology from our team as well on that. It has some details of what happened around networking and network capacity. I will defer to the blog post for specifics. There is a postmortem that has been said that we'll be going through, and we'll be looking into it further. But for those people who were affected, we deeply apologize, and we will be working on that further to make sure it never happens again.
Always a good thing to kind of read up on and kind of understand, like, this is the real world. Things are hard.
Yep.
Problems happen. And so, you know, our team obviously is going to learn a lot from it. And, you know, hopefully people out there can kind of read the details and see why it happened.
Exactly.
Well, enough cool things of the week. I think we've gone through a lot there. Let's get right into our interview, right?
Let's do it. So this week, very happy to have Angela Yu here on the podcast joining us, developer advocate for Google Maps Platform. How are you doing, Angela?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today, joining both Mark and Mark.
Don't worry, Mark's here.
Yeah, you're here too. It's okay. To talk to us all about Google Maps and the Google Maps Platform. So before we get stuck in, do you want to tell us a little about yourself and what you do here at Google?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a developer advocate. I think we've had developer advocates on the podcast before, but really what that means for me is I care a lot about how the developers experience our APIs. And as I'm out there talking with developers and learning how they use our APIs, I bring that back to the product teams and I tell the teams what is important to developers so that we can improve our APIs.
So that makes sense, but let's, and we'll take just a high level step back here just in case. Mm-hmm. Tell us what Google Maps is.
I feel like that Virgin America video, the safety video, is like for the 0.1% of you that haven't used Google Maps. Google Maps is really your window into the real world. We have made a lot of investment in collecting all the data of what exists in our physical world all over the planet. We've tried to be as complete as possible, covering the oceans and the land masses, and we invest a lot in keeping that data fresh. So we're doing like 25 million updates to our data a day. And that's like updating what business is at, what location, or what's changed in a roads, or there's been some flooding. All of that from just like very tabular textual data about, you know, listings, but also visual data, imagery. We've seen that we have satellite imagery for overhead. We have aerial imagery for more of the low altitude, like 45 degree angles of buildings. And we have street view. We've seen the famous street view cars driving around on the streets, capturing really at that address level and at that building level, what you see on the streets. And something I didn't know before I joined Google Maps was not only are there street view vehicles, but there are street view backpacks for hikers to take. You can see this site called Street View Treks that you can see really amazing views of the world of areas that are really hard to get to, like the front face in Yosemite of, what's that big rock?
There's a big rock. I don't know.
There's a lot of big rocks.
There are.
Yeah, like that, and in the Himalayas, and basically, like, you can take a backpack, you can take a tricycle.
Is it El Capitan?
El Capitan.
There we go. I just looked it up.
Soaring over 3,590 feet, El Capitan is a bucket list destination overlooking Yosemite National Park.
Clearly, I'm not a hiker. But we've enabled bringing that Street View 360-degree imagery experience out to the most remote corners of the world in order to give you any kind of window you want to see.
Nice. Well, as someone who grew up with a physically bound paper, like, map that made me drive
maps.
Around,
yeah.
We had one called the Melways because I lived in Melbourne, Australia. It's called the Melways. Thank you so much for getting rid of that for me.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have used Google Maps, I mean, hopefully to kind of replace some of the older mapping stuff. You know, we have this live, and like you were saying, you're pulling in a tremendous amount of data, but there's also a Google Maps API for other people who want to kind of pull in their own data, right?
That's true, yes. So the API allows you to bring all of that data that we've collected into your own apps, because everybody has their own view of the world. You know, it's not just like what is out there and what is public, but you might care about where are you and where are the things that you care about, whether that's from a personal level, like the people in your life, or if you track like your personal property, if that's moving around, or if you're a business, an organization, and you want to track your physical assets out there in the world.
So what sort of things are people doing with the Google Maps API? What are some good examples?
The really cool thing about working on the Google Maps API is it spans everyone from the individual hobbyist developer to the largest enterprises, because everybody has some reason to be interested in location. Google Maps API is kind of often the first Google API that a developer will use, just because as we're experimenting, we're learning new apps, it's really satisfying to pull in a map and have that show up on your app, whether it's on web or mobile. And it's one of the simplest APIs to use. So in the beginning, individual developers can start using location data just to show things like, where is my user, and show you that geolocation. And then you can broaden that to, if you are an app that wants to show the user certain things around them that is not generally what the regular Google Maps app would show, which would be a lot of businesses, you might want to show them specific things like EV charging stations or things that are specific to what the purpose of your app is. That is really useful to both tap into our database and or maybe you have a custom database of your own of where things are geolocated that you want to show around the user. And also for all different kinds of users, you can use the information of what is around the environment or where things are located to help users make decisions. So if you're trying to decide, I have some resources, and where should I concentrate those resources? I want to find out where are they needed. You want to be able to look at a map to find out where the most action is in order to deploy your resources to that location.
Like a rideshare company, for example.
Exactly, yeah.
Is this limited to, like, if I saw it, like, I know I've seen Google Maps embedded on a web page. Is it limited to that kind of view, or could I use the data in other formats? Like, how does this, like, end up being a user experience?
Displaying a map is kind of the most popular way to use our API, but we also have a very rich database of places. So that includes businesses, but also just general places like parks or government buildings, and all of that rich database is available through the Places API. Mm. And then there's also the Routes API that gives you access to things like the directions, whether through driving or walking or biking, transit, and roads. Say you are that ride-sharing company and you're seeing a geolocation of like one of your drivers and they're nebulously like off of a road, you can snap it to a real road that they must be on. And so all of those APIs are available through the Maps platform.
So there's location, there's kind of like how you actually do routing and then moving some things around. I think we've actually seen some pretty interesting use cases recently of games implementing this to create kind of an augmented reality experience as well.
Yeah. Real world gaming is a big trend. It was really popularized by Pokemon Go. And from that, we have expanded our API to game developers to enable real world gaming, where there's a playable locations API, where game developers can identify where are good places for people to have real world interactions with things in the game. And last year, there were 5 games released using that API, and there will be a lot more this year. But one of the most successful ones is like Walking Dead. So like wherever you are, you can see like a zombie attacks coming. And you might have to collaborate with other players in order to defeat the zombies. So these are really fun things that you can do to bring that digital experience and the real world experience together.
Can we make sure there's a real zombie API just in case? You know, just in case that does happen.
Just in case.
It'd be nice to have a map saying, hey, go here, don't go here.
Yeah, if you want your zombie API as part of the Maps API that tracks all the zombies.
Yes, I will definitely prioritize that feature.
Thank you, appreciate that. Thank you so much.
And it sounds like, you know, there's a couple of games that have been using it. Mm-hmm. What other kind of trends have you been seeing of people trying to adopt this and maybe create some new experiences?
Yeah. You know, we say the problem of showing a map and dropping a pin on it has been solved for 10 years. So we're really looking at what are the new things that people are doing with it. You know, obviously, mobile has been bringing a lot of interesting use cases to how people use the Maps platform, because geolocation around mobile device is kind of critical information for anyone that's moving around. Beyond that, I come from actually an IoT background, Internet of Things. And this is the idea of connected things, not just phones and computers, but like any asset could be connected to the internet. And especially when those things are out in the physical world, they all have location. And it's very important to whoever cared to connect to that thing to know where that is. So we've seen a lot of organizations, both from the enterprise to consumer realm, be interested in collecting data off of these things, mapping them so that they can show the status of things out in the world, and maybe like many things in one area are all showing the same state or are trending one way, and then they can make better decisions based on that. One example that I saw recently was one of our Google developer experts. These are external developers that have used our APIs extensively. He has built a prototype of tracking bike sharing bikes and where they're moving around. And he's feeding it to a Firebase database and then pulling that database information, displaying it on a Google map. And that really shows the hotspots of where these bikes are actually being used. So then a bike sharing company could use that data and better deploy where their bikes should be available, because the worst thing is if they were to put them off in where they think the biking locations are and nobody actually is trying to use it from there. That's a really interesting project that he open sourced it, and it's out there on Hackster. We can put a link to it in the show notes.
Yep.
But I think that's a really great example of using IoT data, displaying it on a map, and being able to make a lot better decisions based on that data.
I think you brought up something interesting there, too, where you were talking about Firebase and the Maps API.
Mm-hmm.
Given that we're the Google Cloud Platform podcast, are you seeing like interesting interactions or grouping of technology with Google Cloud, with the Maps API mishmashing together? Like, how does that look to you?
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest trends that we see is the big data visualization. And we have a really great code lab that shows you how to query big data from BigQuery and bring that into a Google map. So then any data that you have that has a location aspect to it can then be put on a map, and you can process really huge data sets and be able to visualize them and like really communicate and tell stories about what is important in that data that you just couldn't really surface before. One of the really interesting things in big data, there's the BigQuery public data sets. If you don't have your own data set, you can play with these public data sets and do really interesting things just to, you know, practice that muscle and see what you can do in terms of data visualizations of location-based data. But there's also an open source library called deck.gl that lets you build really beautiful data visualizations. They have all these layers that you can put over a Google map that are specialized for different kinds of data. Like if you had like the routes of one of the public data sets is the New York City taxi and limousine services and like all of the trips that the taxis have been taking, you can use their trips layer to actually draw on a map, the kind of like time lapse view of the trips that all of these taxis were taking in a time period. It just works really well, and it handles huge data sets really well. So that's one of the things that we announced at I/O was integration with deck.gl that we're really excited for our developers to try.
Neat.
Very cool. Were there any other kind of cool announcements from I/O?
From the Maps platform side, we have a new SDK for Android that we've put out for beta. And so we're really looking for developers to try it out, give us feedback before we release the GA version.
What makes this particular version for Android particularly special?
We have actually brought it out standalone from the Google Mobile Core so that we can release more frequently. Basically, that takes us out of their release cycle and puts us on a more frequent release cycle. And there are a lot of rendering improvements for performance.
So with all those kind of use cases you were just talking about, and now that a lot of people can get their hands on it, what would you say is the coolest experience you've seen built with Google Maps, right? Like, the visualization sounds pretty awesome, but think about what's the next step?
I mean, we had zombies. What's better than zombies?
I don't know if we can top zombies.
I think there are a lot of really complex things that are coming up in the world, and now it's possible to process these really complex decisions So I'm really excited to see, you know, what's possible with ride-sharing companies are really doing very complex routing with us, because they not only have to go from point A to point B, but consider all these other stops in between and optimizations. And what I am most passionate about is augmented reality and seeing that go beyond just the gaming applications of augmented reality, but also how we see the data on the world around us overlaid. So one of the big things in the Android Google Maps app is the augmented reality walking directions, which really helps people navigate, especially in big cities, when they're trying to orient themselves. And augmented reality arrows that kind of show you exactly where to walk, those are very helpful. And I see a lot of more applications coming out for making those kinds of experiences of showing you what you're looking for actually overlaid on your physical world. If you wanted to know kind of like the weird stuff that we've seen, really whimsical things. And one of the most whimsical things that has kind of stood the test of time is this idea of making an earth sandwich.
What is an earth sandwich? Besides delicious, I'm sure.
So it's kind of like the idea that every kid has of like, if I dig a tunnel all the way to the other side of the world, where will I end up?
Burnt alive.
That idea of you being on one side of the world and what is on the other side of this sphere, this globe, those two points on the globe are called antipodes. And there are map tools that let you find antipodes of like from where you are.
Oh, cool.
And most of the landmass, actually, the antipode is in the water. So there's actually only, I think, 4% of the world that you could have a land-to-land sandwich. And so these maps were created to help people find antipodes. Like New Zealand has an antipode in Spain, for people to partner up and try to make synchronize so that they can put a piece of bread on one side and a piece of bread on the other side.
Oh, that's where the sandwich comes in.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and so there are videos where people document themselves putting a piece of bread on this specific latitude and longitude, and their partner doing it on the other side, and they have successfully created an earth sandwich.
Oh, which probably would be there's going to be a lot of disappointed six-year-olds out there who hear that they can't. They'll probably end up with water, though.
Yeah.
Some galactic entity is just like, good.
Yeah, actually, with students, one of the most popular tools in the classroom is this website called The True Size, because if you are a map nerd, you know that the maps we're used to seeing are very distorted to how the countries actually lay out on the globe's surface. And so we are so used to seeing these flat maps that our ideas of the size of countries gets really distorted. And there's this interactive web page called The True Size, where you can drag a country to the equator or overlay it on any other country to compare their sizes and see how actually large or small they are.
What was your biggest surprise when you tried this?
One of my biggest surprises was I didn't realize that Mexico is actually as tall as the contiguous U.S. And Canada and Russia look really huge, but actually when you bring them down to the equator, they're much smaller. I think Russia's still like really big compared to other countries, but it's not as humongous as it looks on the flat map.
Yeah, I mean, there was that update, I don't remember when it was, but there was an update to Google Maps, the interface, where if you zoom out far enough, it switched from that kind of standard Mercator projection into the globe one, right?
Yeah, that is just like, it just switches to that satellite view, and it just goes to that really true representation of the world. It's funny that you mentioned Mercator projection, because there's an XKCD comic that actually types you based on your favorite map projection. And if Mercator is your favorite, then like you're kind of just like a, you know, a lemming that goes along with whatever's fed to you in the world.
I was going to say I love the Mercator projection for its nice, flat, and even distribution, but I guess I'm not. I'm
impressed you know what the word Mercator is, because I have no idea.
I took a geology class 15 years ago. I know things.
You paid attention.
Actually, interesting question then. So we were having an actually short conversation before we started about all the different like latitude and longitude standards or how you track maps and stuff. If I'm using the Maps API, do I need to go take like a geology class or something? Like geography or whatever it is that I
do? I do
not
recommend it.
Yeah, like do I need to do that, or does it make it simpler, or how does that work?
I think we've tried to make it as simple as possible. The latitude and longitude, I think you might be used to seeing it expressed in like minutes and seconds in this sexagesimal. Wait, but when you actually use like Google Maps on your computer or on your phone, you'll see latitude and longitude expressed in a decimal way. So it's still going to be like the same first two or three numbers, like 122 degrees west. And then instead of like having to convert in your mind to like minutes and seconds, it's actually just decimal.
I just do that conversion in my mind all the time. It's just what I do for fun.
The formula's written on the back of your hand.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's in my head. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And then, so like, if I like, oh, this sounds awesome and I want to get started, where do I begin? Where should I go?
You know, one of the things that I've been really happy about since I started is every time I talk to an external developer, they tell me the documentation is great. So I'd start with our documentation. We have a ton of tutorials on there. We have from the most simple, like just show a map, to actually call a complex distance matrix to figure out all of the different times and distances of multiple routes to get from point A to point B. And all of that is provided in tutorials. We have code samples. We have code labs to teach you some of the most common tasks. And all of that is out there. On GitHub, we have a Google Maps organization that has a bunch of repos for client libraries and utility libraries. So on the regular Maps platform, we have the JavaScript API, Android SDK, and iOS SDK, and we have a bunch of REST APIs. But in our GitHub organization, we have client libraries for Java, for Node, and Go, Python, and kind of almost anything that you might want to program in.
And so the process for someone to get started, just like any other API, they can just go to the GCP console, enable the Maps API, get the key, and then start with any of those tutorials, right?
Yeah. And one of the great things about us is that we, on top of any credits that you've already gotten through Google Cloud Platform, you also get a $200 monthly credit recurring for the Maps APIs. So your first $200 of Maps API spend is free every month. And so that covers any kind of like experimentation or development that you want to do to just try things out before you actually go into production and get a lot of users. So with that, we try to encourage and enable more of that experimentation and playing around before it starts to cost you anything.
That sounds great. And it sounds like, so that's being charged as a separate product. Is that billing unified with like cloud? Do I need to set up a separate account or anything like that?
No, it's all built into your Google Cloud account. For any project that you set up, you just want to go into the API libraries or marketplace and enable the Maps APIs that you want to use.
So is there anything else that a developer would need to know to get started?
It's really self-explanatory.
that's a good claim.
We have a really great technical writing team. We invest a lot in keeping our documentation up to date.
Yep.
And I personally am really invested in keeping our samples updated. And all of our libraries and samples on GitHub are open source. So we really encourage the community to submit pull requests, open issues, let us know if things are not working for them or if they have ideas for ways that our libraries could perform better. Have at it.
What's a demo you wish someone would build?
One of my pet projects is with augmented reality, showing names and ratings on buildings overlaid like right around you. Because whenever I travel to a foreign country and it might be harder for me to understand, or it's a very dense place, it can be really hard to match up like an address to a building that has no numbers on it.
Right.
So having that like kind of translation and overlay to help me kind of figure out where to eat or where is this place that I was told to go to that I can't figure out. I think that's kind of like my next big use case that I would really love to see.
Yeah. So like standing on a street and you're like, that place is 3 stars. That place is 5 stars. That is where
exactly.
It sounds like we're not far, right? I mean, you were just mentioning the AR and kind of the things that people have built with it. The IO app for people who went to IO, you actually had augmented reality to tell you where like the stages were and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully someone who hears this is like, I can do this, and just builds that kind of like restaurant finder or, you know, place finder.
Yeah. Especially if you're using Android, combining our Maps API with AR Core. That could be really powerful. And yeah, just anything where like data is overlaid on the physical world around you. I love that.
Awesome. Well, before we finish up here, is there anything that we haven't managed to mention or anything you want to make sure you plug or anything you just want the audience to know about before we wrap up?
You know, our developer advocate team, you know, we're always looking for events where we should, you know, be at. So I am Wangela on Twitter. So if you have an event that you want us to go and talk about Google Maps or like what you can do, we'd be happy to present at your event, meetup, conference, anything. So just hit me up on Twitter.
Fantastic. Are you going to be anywhere in particular in the near future you want people to know about?
We're still planning out the rest of the year. Okay. So I think the usual suspects, like the Chrome Dev Summit, things like that.
Wait, we're here in San Francisco. Where's the Earth Sandwich side of San Francisco?
Unfortunately, I think it's in the water.
Oh, it's going to be a soggy sandwich.
It would be.
Yeah. It's an open sandwich.
Oh, open face. That seems cheap. You could just put bread on anything and call it an open face sandwich.
Just saying, it's a thing.
That's true. You can't argue that.
We're generous with terms here.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today and telling us all about maps.
Thank you, Mark and Mark.
Thanks,
it's great
Angela.
Being here.
Thanks. Thanks to Angela for joining us this week on the podcast to talk about Google Maps. Really interesting topic, hearing about real-world locations and how people can incorporate those in our applications and their games, of course. So, yeah, thanks so much for joining us.
And other creative ideas like a sandwich.
Yes,
around
and sandwiches.
The Earth.
Sandwiches are great. I do like a good sandwich.
It's just, I think everyone can, maybe not everyone can relate to maps, but everyone can relate to sandwiches.
Excellent. Now, I believe you have a question of the week.
I do. Speaking not of sandwiches, but yeah. Instead back to Kubernetes. So we're recently coming off of Kubernetes' five-year
yep.
anniversary,
yeah.
holiday of creating. They've been around for 5 years.
It's a good time.
They've been doing some good stuff.
Yeah.
It turns out it's pretty popular.
A little bit.
So if you get a chance, you know, check out the Kubernetes Twitter and the Kubernetes podcast Twitter, which have a lot of cool content over the past few weeks about the fifth anniversary.
Yep.
One of the interesting tweets I saw was, you know, what's the biggest concern for Kubernetes that people have? And it's pretty clear that the number one answer is, like, understanding how to use Kubernetes. And as I was thinking about that, I said, okay, well, I've done some work with Kubernetes, but a lot of people have talked about Helm, and I've only really, really been at the highest level of Helm.
Okay.
So what the Helm? Like, what is it?
I'm sure that's a joke no one else has ever made.
It has to be the first time. I'll take credit for it. Thank you. So what is Helm? Why is that important?
Okay. So yes. So Helm is an open source project. It's been around for quite a while, actually. We're going to talk primarily about Helm 2, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But it is worth noting, we do have an episode way back in the day, episode 50, talking about Helm with Michelle Nurali and Matthew Butcher, talking about Helm in depth. But at its base level, it's a package manager for Kubernetes. Okay. So what does that mean? So the thing I like to talk about when I talk about Helm is, like, if you've ever used apt on Linux or Yum or like Homebrew or anything like that on a Mac device or Chocolaty on Windows, basically it's like, how do I install X thing plus all the dependencies that it has as well? Because sometimes things are complicated and they have lots of stuff. And so Helm's really nice in that, first of all, it has a series of what they call stable charts. And a chart is the package, basically. So if you're like, I want to install multi-cluster Redis, for example, I can go look for the Redis Helm chart. There are some configurable values that I can push through there, and it's going to go and create all the YAML that needs to be created to basically specify, okay, this is how the Redis configuration should be set up. You've specified that you want this many nodes in it, and like we can set it all up, and all the dependencies are all set up, and it's good to go. So like, sweet, awesome. That works well. The next level of that is also, how do I either delete that, say I don't want it anymore, and make sure it cleans everything up, but also how do I upgrade it? So maybe there's a new version of the chart. There's a new version of Redis coming out. I want to do something like that. Now suddenly I can do a Helm upgrade, and it'll do all the nice dependency changes and all the things I need to change that way so that I can change that platform as I need to change it, which is really nice. The third version of that is that you might have an application yourself. And you might be like, oh, cool, I have this application, and it's dependent on maybe Redis and maybe several other things. So I can set up a chart with subcharts and have dependencies set up that way as well. Maybe there's some configurable values, that kind of stuff. So then I can create a chart specific for my application. I could even publish that publicly if I wanted to as well, so other people could take advantage. You can actually have multiple repositories within Helm, so that if you want to publish your own charts, you can, either internally or publicly. And so it handles that sort of create, install, upgrade, delete lifecycle of complex Kubernetes applications. It's pretty nice. I quite like it. We have one for the project I work on, so it works on Agones. Tracks, you know, when did new versions come up? What version is currently live? What version is available in the repo? pretty comprehensive. I should make note, Helm 3 is coming up. So Helm 3 is actually a full rewrite of Helm. You can still use Helm 2. Helm 2 is great and stable and wonderful. They're getting rid of some dependencies inside the Kubernetes cluster itself. They have a thing called Tiller, usually, that they used to run in there. They're actually taking full advantage of CRDs. If I don't get any of this wrong, you can actually check all this out in the blog post. It's going to be a much more lightweight installation. It's going to be really nice. But that's been developed fully in the open. You can check it all out on GitHub. They were like writing design docs before they wrote any code. It's actually super, super cool. But the 3.0.0 alpha-1 is available if you want to muck around with it. But yeah, Helm's really nice. Suggest checking it out. It's worth having a look at if you have a complex Kubernetes application you want to deploy and you're looking for a way to package that up nicely. Does that answer your question, Mark?
I think so. So let me read that back to you, if that's all right. I mean, basically, you're able to kind of pull down a chart if you want to take some kind of a service, for instance. Like, for instance, you gave an example of Redis.
Yep.
And say, I want this, you know, in-memory database. So you pull down the chart and you kind of deploy it.
Yep.
And of course, if updates get rolled out of that, like a normal package manager, you can say, oh, there's updates available. So I'm going to go grab those. Helm takes care of all the work there and helps deploy it out. But of course, applications are usually more than one service, right? They might be really complex. They might have dependencies.
Yep.
And so you kind of build all that out. Plus, you're able to kind of take your own application, maybe build it up with the chart that has subcharts, and then push that out there if, for instance, like a Gonis, you kind of have this complex tree that you need in order to deploy the app.
Yeah, Gonis is probably a good example as well. I mean, we have a variety of services, some deployments, a whole bunch of RBAC controls in there as well, and a whole bunch of CRDs. Yeah, there's those, and things like that. And so that becomes super nice. And Helm does a really nice job as well of templating. So if you want to have includes or you want to do loops around stuff, basically being able to generate that YAML file sort of on the fly. There's a lot of nice tooling in there that enables you to do that too.
So it sounds like a super cool concept. If people are getting started with Kubernetes, it might be a great way to get an application or a set of services or a set of deployments or a combination of all those kind of up and running pretty quickly. And it sounds like people can go check out the episode 50 in order to see more of a deep dive about Helm and the direction they're going.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Yeah, I think that handles it.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, before we wrap up, Mark, what are you up to? Are you going anywhere cool, doing any neat content?
So I just came back from a long road trip in which I got to listen to lots of podcasts.
Oh, good.
So that was a lot of fun, including our previous episodes. And it's always fun to go back and listen to hear the questions that we're talking about. But we do interview some great people. So it's actually super cool to kind of listen on those and be like, oh, wow, this is awesome. And then, yeah, I'm headed to New York pretty quickly, actually. I think maybe even as early as tomorrow.
Oh, very cool.
To talk to a couple of customers and chat with them about their uses of GCP. For a little show I do on YouTube called Stack Chat, where we kind of interview them about what their architecture looks like, some of the decisions they get made. So it's super cool to kind of go into these customer areas and talk to them and be like, hey, well, why is this important? What did you find along the way?
Yeah. Well, super definitely cool check stuff. Out your YouTube channel.
Awesome. Wow. It's all on the Google Cloud Platform YouTube channel.
I'll check that out. That
so what
good.
About you?
I think next on my radar will be Tokyo Next. That'll be in, strangely enough, Tokyo.
Oh, it's aptly named.
Yeah, aptly named. We do name things what they are, generally speaking.
So what does a Gonis do?
Yeah, not our open source projects, very different. So yeah, Tokyo Next in July. So yeah, if you're going to be around Tokyo, make sure to say hello. I will be at the Inside event talking about game stuff.
As always.
Pretty much. Fantastic. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast this week.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Always a pleasure. And thank you all for listening. And we'll see you all next week.
See ya.